20-7008, United States versus Pettit. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And we are ready to proceed whenever you are.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Alan Moritzen on behalf of Mr. Piet. To be honest, I'm kind of guessing myself. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. My primary contention this morning is that both of defendants' convictions should be reversed because the district court abused its discretion in failing to adequately explain its reasons for admitting child molestation evidence and in admitting that evidence. In the alternative, each of defendants' convictions should be reversed for independent reasons. Defendant's traveling with intent conviction should be reversed because it violates the statute of limitations. And his kidnapping conviction should be reversed because the district court plainly erred in instructing the jury that he bore the burden to prove that the government's kidnapping charge fell outside the statute of limitations. Turning first to the evidentiary issues, as the court is aware, the district court appeared to rely on three different theories for the admission of the child molestation evidence. Res geste, again, assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly, or the inextricably intertwined test, rule 404B and rule 414. But regardless of which rule the district court relied upon, the evidence still had to pass muster under rule 403. And that's where I would like to focus my analysis this morning.
First, let me, I want to drill down for a minute. As I understand it, your argument on 403 starts with that the district court simply failed to perform an adequate analysis under 403. Am I understanding your argument correctly?
You are understanding my argument correctly, and that's exactly where I was going. This court's precedents from Benally, Castillo, Guardia, make very, very clear that especially in the context of molestation evidence, it is critical that the district court carefully and thoroughly evaluate the record and perform an analysis both as to probative value and as to unfair prejudice. And instead, what we received from the district court was a conclusory statement that the unfair prejudice of this evidence was certainly did not substantially outweigh its probative value. And so that adds to my denial of the motion in limine. And if you read it is virtually indistinguishable from the statement made in United States versus Castillo, where the court said that it failed to satisfy the court's minimum requirements. And in fact, the day before we filed our reply brief, Judge White performed a much more thorough analysis demonstrating an understanding of this requirement in United States versus Mosquito, 2021 Westlaw 1255182. But I also would direct the court's attention or make the argument that even it had the court performed the analysis required under this court's cases, it would have violated each of these rules, and especially Rule 403, to admit this evidence. Starting with the question of probative value, as the court is aware, typically, when child molestation evidence is introduced, it is because there is a direct credibility dispute between the alleged perpetrator and the alleged victim, meaning that the victim claims to have been abused and the perpetrator denies that the abuse occurred. And so Congress, in its judgment, enacted Rule 414 to essentially bolster the credibility of the victim in those circumstances. But of course, here, as the government itself said in its closing statement, there was literally no dispute as to the sexual relations between the defendant and the victim. And so it's difficult to see what probative value was added by this molestation evidence performed with respect to persons who were not victims of the alleged offense.
I think one of the arguments that is made is that you have argued that the statute ran on the kidnapping offense because she was free to leave and she could have left. And one of the arguments is she couldn't leave unless she could get all of her children out with her because she was fearful that they would be victims of sexual assault. And so the evidence of sexual assault was offered as proof of her inability to leave unless she could take all, I guess at that time, 8 children with her.
That's correct. That I will concede or grant the point that the question of her consent was a central theme at trial, and it was the primary argument defendant made in response to the kidnapping charge. The problem with relying on the molestation evidence to disprove that point is that she herself testified that she was not aware that it was occurring. Her daughter testified that she denied that it was occurring when asked about it. And so her suspicion by itself, although I suppose potentially marginally probative, was dramatically outweighed by the graphic and horrifying way in which that molestation evidence was described.
There's two issues there, I think. Okay. One is whether it had relevance. The other is whether there should have been some attempt by the trial judge to control the volume and detail of the molestation evidence to prevent the prejudice from outweighing the probative value. And it's not entirely clear to me that you made the second argument to the district court.
That we made that it was we made the argument that it was excessively graphic.
Yes.
I feel quite sure that we made the argument that it was unfairly prejudicial in terms of the detail that it was provided.
Okay.
But I do not have a record site ready. And so I would provide that to the court after the argument, if possible.
That's fine. You can submit a 28J letter if you would like.
Okay. But I take the point. I think regardless, I mean, to suggest that our making the argument that admitting this evidence violated Rule 403 was insufficient to preserve the argument that the unfair prejudice associated with the graphic detail dramatically outweighed whatever marginal probative value was associated with that evidence, it does not seem, in my mind, consistent with the preservation requirements that this court has traditionally imposed. Because after all, Rule 403, what it requires is a balancing test between the evidence that the government proposes to introduce, the unfair prejudice associated with that evidence weighed against whatever probative value that it adds. And so by making the argument to the district court, even before trial, that it would violate Rule 403, regardless again of which of the three theories the district court relied upon, seems sufficient in my mind to preserve the argument that the court abused its discretion or would have abused its discretion had it performed the balancing test that this court's cases require.
Counsel, can I stop you there? Could I get you to talk specifically about res gestae and how, I guess, in your view, that doesn't justify the admission here?
Well, the way I understand the res gestae doctrine, and again, well, let me just start with that. The way I understand it is that it applies, it is the equivalent of the inextricably intertwined test, which means that the government is incapable of proving that the crimes occurred without introducing the evidence in question. And so when I talk about the fact that leaving this evidence out would have left no temporal or analytical gaps in the government's theory of the case, that's what I'm getting at, is that it is not inextricably intertwined with either the traveling with intent charge, which again has nothing to do with his biological daughters, or with the kidnapping charge, which again focuses on the question of the mother's consent, who was, and I return to her testimony, who was not aware that the molestation evidence was occurring. And so under the government's theory, anything that Mr. Piett did over the 20 years that he was alleged to have held Ms. McGinnis against her will was fair game because it occurred while the crime was occurring. And I think that that's an overbroad definition of res gestae. And I think that's why members of this court have criticized the inextricably intertwined test, because it becomes very loose and very hard to distinguish between what's intertwined and what's not intertwined, and it still has to survive analysis under Rule 403. And I think it returns to this point about, is the marginal probative value associated with her ability to leave or her consent to her circumstances outweighed by the graphic and horrifying nature in which the molestation evidence was described? I prefer not to summarize it here. You can read page 42 of our opening brief to see what was introduced.
I believe Judge Ebel has a question.
Well, how is there, you ever made a proffer of consented to a conclusion about sexual assault of the children that would have asked the judge to minimize the graphic nature of that testimony?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
Well, I'm wondering if you ever tried to avoid the graphic nature of the assaults on the children by making a proffer to the court that you would concede that the children were sexually abused.
Not to my knowledge, we did not make a proffer. As I mentioned to Judge McHugh, what we argued was that admission of the evidence violated Rule 403. We did not offer to stipulate that they were molested. And again, that's based on the tangential, I think at best, relationship between that molestation and Ms. McGinnis's consent.
I would suppose that the argument that's relevant because it offered a reason why she was afraid to leave until she could get the kids out has a relatively minimal value because she didn't know of that molestation until pretty soon before she actually did leave. Isn't that right?
That's correct. To my understanding of the record, she was not aware of the molestation until after she had appeared at the consulate,
Didn't a couple of the kids contradict her on that? One of her daughters testified that she actually told her mother what was going on. And then one of the sons testified that it was pretty out in the open what was going on, and that he observed the mother trying to keep the daughters away from Mr. Pettit.
The testimony, again, that the briefs cite, both the opening brief and the United States response brief, is that Ms. McGinnis denied that she knew of the molestation, and Ma P denied that it was occurring when asked about it. And the strongest evidence that I recollect from the record that it was occurring was Ms. McGinnis's testimony that she suspected that it might be occurring, but that she had no actual knowledge. I was hoping to get to some of the other issues, but I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Ms. Epperle?
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Linda Epperle. I represent the government. Initially, we would like to impress upon the court the horrific nature of this case. And I mention that only because since there was not a sufficiency of the evidence argument made, we provided a short summary of what we felt was necessary for the court to understand in assessing these issues. But should there come a time when this court needs to look at whether or not the evidence was overwhelming or whether or not there was evidence to support the things that the trial court did, we would just urge the court to consider that there were several witnesses, including experts, et cetera, that are not mentioned in our brief.
How do we deal with the problem of the erroneous shifting of the burden of proof on statute of limitations? Is that going to require a new trial no matter what else happens?
No, Your Honor, for the following reasons. First of all, the statute of limitations issue is not a situation where the court changed the burden of proof. This was simply a situation where if the jury found the defendant guilty under the instructions for what they had to prove kidnapping, the court needed some guidance, if that was true, in trying to go back and reassess the statute of limitations issue, and therefore presented a special interrogatory to the jury simply to say, do you believe that the proof showed that Rosalyn attempted to escape before 2016, and if so, on what date?
But it did more than that. It instructed the jury specifically that it was the defendant's burden to prove that.
Only if they had already found the defendant guilty on count one, Your Honor.
What difference does it make? I mean, it's an issue of you've got the defendant has raised a statute of limitations defense. And the case law from the Supreme Court and this court is pretty clear that once the defendant raises that defense, the burden is on the prosecution to prove that the action was brought timely. And here the trial court gave an instruction that seems to me to be directly contrary to the law.
This special interrogatory indicated that the defendant needed to prove that by preponderance of the evidence that it was more likely than not. However, the jury would not have gotten to that issue had they not found, based upon all of the prior instructions, that the defendant was guilty of the elements of kidnapping beyond a reasonable doubt. The other thing that we would urge this court
I'm trying to understand the argument you're making. Are you trying to argue it's an affirmative defense? Is that the argument you're making?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yes, if I think it's a statute of limitations argument, then you would concede that it was error?
No, Your Honor, we would not. We believe that this court looks at in the instructions as a whole under the Corrigan case and looking at whether the instructions as a whole inform the jury of the government's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That was done here. Secondly, this issue is reviewed before this court only on plain error. It was not raised below, so it certainly was not any sort of obvious error that this extremely...
Well, you say it's not obvious, but we have clear precedent that it is that if the defendant raises statute of limitations, it is the government's burden to prove that it's been satisfied. And that's just plain contrary to the instruction that was given. My question is, if we think it was contrary, just assume that for a moment, for my benefit, would we have to remand the entire thing for a retrial, or is parts of it still salvageable?
I believe that the verdicts are still salvageable, Your Honor, because this is a plain error issue. We certainly don't concede there was error, but if this court should find that Judge White, in his attempt to completely analyze the statute of limitations issue throughout the trial, as he told them he would do when he first ruled on statute of limitations, the defendant cannot meet the other standards of the plain error test. We don't believe there was error. We don't believe it was plain. But most importantly, it would not have affected this defendant's substantive rights because...
The evidence, I think a jury could reasonably have found that she was free to go much earlier than the statute here. She made independent trips to the United States. He was in jail various times and she bailed him out. There were times when she and all her children were away from the defendant. I have a hard time saying that the evidence was so clear on the statute of limitations issue that even if we find it's error and the error was plain, we could say it didn't make any difference.
Your Honor, there were questions, and part of the difficulty in presenting this case, other than the number of witnesses and the time that it covered, was the fact that they were left alone. However, this is where we would implore the court to consider the record as a whole. These people lived, he went out of his way to make sure he had total control over this family. He had them living in shacks and tents 15 to 20 miles from the nearest city in Mexico. The victim had not been in school since fifth grade when he pulled her out in 1997. Those kids had never been to school. They couldn't read. They couldn't write. They didn't know how clocks worked or calendars. They rarely spoke to anyone outside of that family except the people that they begged from or stole from. It was important to us to be able to explain to the jury exactly the question that Your Honor is asking. How could she not have left? The important way that she could not have left was she knew when her mother left, she was left behind. And the defendant had threatened to abuse her to her own mother, trying to get her own mother to stay. And he was doing the exact same thing here.
And those are all really good jury arguments for why the jury should have found in your, you know, even with the correct burden of proof in your favor. But I think you got to give them the correct burden of proof when instruct them. Let me turn away from this issue for a minute and talk and raise with you, looking at the record of the 403 analysis by the district court, it does seem wholly inadequate. We have instructed the courts that they have to take that seriously, and there's just virtually nothing on the weighing. And I'll tell you, I've been an appellate judge for 15 years, and I've seen some awful stuff in records I've had to read. This testimony was some of the worst I've ever seen in terms of the graphic nature of it and the upsetting. I am sort of surprised that there wasn't some attempt made to control the impact of that very graphic and somewhat tangential evidence.
The evidence was graphic. However, Your Honor, in the context of the rest of what was presented about the lives that this victim and the children had to leave, it was not prejudicially graphic. I would agree, going back to the court's first question about the balancing, I would agree that there is very little balancing available on the record. Although the court addressed this issue not only in ruling on the initial motions, but repeatedly throughout trial, giving limiting instructions each time anything tangentially constituting other crimes evidence was raised. And our brief gives citations for those exact items. There was also discussion during those bench conferences. But I'm also aware, and I hope that this particular judge is as well, as opposing counsel indicated, there was a recent decision after we filed our briefs in which there was much more balancing put into the record. But this court held in Magnin, a case also dealing with very troubling sexual abuse, where there was also an inadequate explanation of the factors this court set forth in Ejaidi. But in Magnin, this court said, we recognize that our court can conduct a de novo review of the 403 factors without requiring a remand. And that is the result that the government would ask for in this case. Also, after both parties filed their briefs, this court issued...
I'm intrigued about Magnum, give me the cite to that.
Yes, Your Honor. 756 Federal Appendix, so it is unpublished at 807, 2018 case. It's cited, I think, I'm sure, in our briefs.
Okay, but all of you, you've now said it's unpublished, which probably is the reason it's not on my, one of the reasons it's not on my radar screen, but usually we just got all kinds of precedent to say the balancing is not something the appellate court can do because we didn't hear the witnesses. That is, if there's one thing that is really within the province of the trial court, it's a 403 balancing. So, I mean, maybe there were facts in Magnum that said, well, here's an exception, but I can't believe that we would ever say as a matter of law that we can just routinely balance 403 when the district court didn't do it.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we don't think that we would routinely ask this court to do that. And this comes back to my comments about the horrific, almost unthinkable nature of this case. I would point out that in Magnum, although it is unpublished, the citation that I was reading from lists several cases, including a 10th Circuit case, United States versus Lasco Villalobos, which was a 1999 case at 175 Fed 3rd 838, holding that the court could conduct a de novo balancing where the trial court did not make explicit findings. We have no doubt that the correct result on all of this other crimes evidence was reached. The only portion of this entire argument that gives us any pause is the court's failure to be more specific on the record about that balancing. In other words, the court did not show its work, but there is ample evidence within this record to preserve this conviction.
How could it be preserved if the burden of proof was erroneously put on the defendant and the standard of proof was erroneous on statute of limitations? If we found that error occurred, and you're saying it didn't occur, and we'll have to make that decision, I guess. But if it did occur, wouldn't that just mandate a new trial?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily. We believe, again, that the kidnapping and the instructions issue is a plain error issue, and that there is overwhelming evidence here that he committed this crime, and that even a different instruction would not have changed this outcome, which he must show under the plain error. On the traveling count as to the statute of limitations, the court here did recognize that statute of limitations are to be applied with repose, but the court also recognized that Congress in this particular type of case cast a wide net to try to get as many of these cases as possible under that new statute of limitations. And the 414 evidence that particularly applies to the 403 balancing that may or may not have been done, that testimony only comprised about 3 pages of this 7-day trial.
I'm sorry, did you have a question, Judge Ebell?
No.
Oh, on the 414 issue, you cite a bunch of cases and say these cases all support letting this in. Every single one of those cases is a case where the defendant has denied that he actually committed the sexual abuse. Here, not only does the defendant admit it, you've got a child that was born of the sexual abuse that you can do the math and show she was a minor when she became pregnant with the child. And you can look at the DNA and see who it is. Why are the cases that you cite then relevant here for all of this evidence of that has nothing to do with the abuse of the mother? I'm trying not to use names.
I understand. And we've used first names for the reason described in our brief. First, for 2 reasons. First of all, for him to admit that he had sexual relations with the mother, the victim, does not solve the problem, because we don't question that there was an actual sex that took place. He used that in taunting his son that you are the evidence. I see that my time has expired. We'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. And I believe you have a little over 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll try to just make 2 quick points. The first having to do with the question of de novo 403 balancing on appeal. I'm not sure exactly if United States versus Mannion supports that. I do know that in that case, the defendant did not object to the admission of the Rule 414 evidence. And so the review in that case was for plain error, which of course distinguishes that case from this case. The only other thing that I would add on the burden of proof instruction, I really do think that the court's decision in United States versus Duran is directly on point. And in that case, which dealt with an entrapment defense, the jury instruction simply articulated the elements of the entrapment defense without assigning either party the burden of proof. And this court said that by failing to make clear that the government retained the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt as to that defense was plain error. And because that defense was the core aspect of the defendant's defense in that case, it also affected the defendant's substantial rights and satisfied every element of the plain error inquiry. I really do not see how that case can be distinguished here.
May I ask a question, Judge McHugh?
Yes, of course.
That seems to me would address the kidnapping issue if that is a misallocation of burden of proof. How do we deal with the other issue of sex with a minor? Does that have the same defect, or would that part of the verdict not be overturned?
Well, if I could say three very quick things. First, we think the traveling with intent should be overturned based on the deficient Rule 403 analysis, which infects the entire trial. Second, we think the traveling with intent charge was outside the statute of limitations, as spelled out in our brief. But third, given the emphasis that this court's precedent has placed on the burden of proof and the correct instruction as to the burden of proof, I don't know how you can say that assigning the defendant the burden of proof on his central defense did not infect the entire trial and warrants a new trial.
Is that defense, statute of limitations defense, that applies to the kidnapping for sure, but does it apply to the entire traveling? Because they certainly had some traveling within the statute of limitations time period.
That's correct. We made a separate statute of limitations arguments below. The statute of limitations as to the traveling with intent charge dealt with the retroactivity of amendments that had been made to statutes.
Let's say we disagree with your arguments there.
Well, as I said, I still think it warrants retrial given the fundamental nature of the burden of proof, even if the burden of proof misinstruction was only limited to the kidnapping charge.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we'd ask the court to reverse the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. We will take this matter under advisement.